Mr. James Rainfall.
So I realized that we'd been attacked. And just then, about 30 or so Japanese came rushing round to the front of my position. Just to refresh the memory, I had a section of Gurkhas with me, that is, they hobbled on, about 6 or 7 Gurkhas and myself. Anyway, these 30 Japs came rushing across the front of me. They were all armed, they had steel helmets on, and they stopped for a moment in a bunch to look at the Japs we'd already killed. And of course they were a sitting target, so we let them have it with everything we had. And I think we probably killed most of them. Some were moaning out, but there was no way we were going forward to see them because they were very treacherous, even when wounded. But about half a dozen or so may have escaped to the left. And then I heard a lot of firing behind, and the right from Blaine, and the left from either Jemadar. So I said to the Havildar, look, it's obvious we should move now. We have to move out. Well, before we could do that, we were counterattacked by another 6 or 7, perhaps Japs, 8, who suddenly came through the jungle. One Gurkha was killed at once. Then our Bren gunner started firing from the hip, and there was a bit of a melee, and my Havildar was killed with a bayonet. It was bayoneted, although I did have the satisfaction of killing the chap who'd killed him. Anyway, we killed the Japs, and then there were only, on reflection, there were probably only 4 of us. 4 Gurkhas and 3 were killed. There were the Havildar, 2 other Gurkhas were killed. And there were 4 Gurkhas and the Karen, myself, left. And I decided, right, we must go. So we started to move out. And the whole place, the jungle, was full of Japs everywhere. So I was just wondering how the hell we were going to get out. When suddenly, in front of us, this is a sort of scrub country. You see, it's a pretty thick sort of jungly country. Our 3-inch mortar started landing amongst the Japanese, you see. And what had happened, you see, that Calvert, as soon as he realized that I'd landed something big, he'd sent Dennis Gudgeon with a couple of sections to see what was happening. And Dennis bumped into my Jemadar on the left flank, and they went back to the column, where Dennis was able to tell Calvert some idea of what was happening. So he started firing the mortar bombs, which sort of blasted a sort of a gap, and we went straight through it, and then we managed to get across into the back to the column, who was camped there. 2 Gurkhas from my back lot arrived, and they said the rest had been killed. Sergeant Blaine then turned up with all his men and said he'd had a great time because a whole lot of Japs had come in front of his position and he'd wiped them out. And then he'd come back himself. So we must have... later it was discovered, incidentally, that the letter I discovered that I had captured contained the battalion operation orders of the Japanese and what they've had to do in the future in that area. So there must have been an awful lot of Japs, their whole garrison, but we must have demoralized them because we were a whole hour or more in our camp and they never counterattacked at all. But as I say, it was a sad thing because we lost 9 people, including Tilbury Tarpa, the Havildar, who under normal circumstances would surely have got a posthumous IOM, Indian Order of Merit, nothing else, but because the circumstances of the battalion being broken up, he got nothing. And I think the irony of it is that in the official history that came out, 1953 I think it was, the war in Japan, in describing this particular action, it said that the column had broken up the Japanese garrison without any casualties for the column itself. And I thought that was a terrible irony because here were these 9 Gurkhas who'd given their lives and they were nothing, because they weren't, even in the official history, they were not even killed. And the trouble was, of course, that a lot of books were coming out at that time on the Chindits, and all the authors doing research, and not being in the show themselves, took that for granted. And in fact, there were some very peculiar reports came out about that action altogether. So it was a tragedy, in a sense, that that happened. And then, of course, we moved out, ostensibly to go towards the Gotek Viaduct, but that night, or perhaps the next day, we had a wireless message saying, return to India. So, you know, independently, make your way back. Well, Michael Calvert, I should think, was probably disappointed and upset that he didn't get the Gotek Viaduct. But I'm pretty sure that we would never have, well, if we had got there, I don't think we'd have succeeded at all. If we'd gone straight there originally, we would have. But remember I told you earlier about seeing the wounded in the bullock carts. And although the troops had, they'd fought pretty well at the ambush in Pago, you could begin to tell that, you know, it was coming to the point where they'd given practically everything they had to give. They were at, we hadn't had a wash or a bath for about 2 months. We were stinking. We were tatters, hungry, thirsty. And I think that and then everyone began to realize that if anything happened to them now, it would be most unfortunate, which, of course, has a basis on morale, especially when you're hungry as well and everything else.
What happened to the chap who was carrying the letter for the Japanese?
The Burmese villager?
Yes.
Well, when the ambush came, he disappeared. He went off. He ran away. We had no time to think about him. In fact, I'd forgotten about that, because, which was one of the reasons why after the ambush I said to my Havildar, I said to him, he told me that the villager had escaped. And I said, well, that's bad, because he'd probably go and tell the Japs where we are, and we should really move out. But because we're waiting for Calvert Sarp to come and join us, we really can't move at the moment, because he must have a jumping-off point. Because that was one of the reason why we stayed there.
So, can you tell me about what happened after you got the orders to return to India?
As I say, Calvert had been told he could come to return to India independently. So he decided he would return to our previous supply drop camp, where I had earlier mentioned that he'd left 4 days' rations in reserve. So we went back there and collected these rations, and then set off to cross the Shweli River with the intention of, after having crossed the river, would be to go up into the Kachin Hills, where the Kachins, the tribe that lived there, were known to be loyal, and perhaps work our way out via China. However, when we reached the Shweli, it was, although by no means as wide or as awkward a river as it seemed, as the Irrawaddy or the Chinwin, it was nonetheless quite an obstacle, because it was fast flowing, and as I say, none of the Gurkhas could swim, quite none of the British people couldn't swim, and there were no villages nearby for boats. So Calvert decided to make sapa sampans, which is sort of a rough boat made out of ground sheets and bamboo. And while he started the building of it and across the river, he left me in a position back on the way we'd come, and he sent Company Sergeant Major Blaine with his troop, the other side, to an ambush. And he just started sending the first lot across when a Japanese patrol walked into Blaine's position. And Blaine promptly exterminated a lot of them. So, this having been done, Calvert decided there was no way he could stay there and try to cross the river, because they're sure to be, the Japs are sure to come along in force. So he decided to move off. So he moved off. When I reached, I had to come and join the column. When I reached the river bank, to my horror, I saw two Gurkhas the other side. What had happened, of course, is the first lot had gone across from their sampans, two Gurkhas and a Karen. When they reached the other side, of course, the trouble started. And meanwhile, the Sapa sampan had been brought back for the next lot, you see. Well, the Karen jumped in and swam back across the river because he could swim, but the two Gurkhas were left. And it must have been a very difficult situation, a decision for Calvert, but in the interest of the column as a whole, he just couldn't wait. He decided he couldn't wait to try and get those two men back. And we had to move off quickly, which we did. And then we laid up for the night. And then the next morning, we marched away from the river, because he'd had a long discussion with the senior officers, all of whom said that the answer was to break up into dispersal groups and make our little way back in small groups. He was against this. Calvert was against this, because he felt the column had worked so well up to now that it wouldn't be wrong to break it up. However, in the end, he listened to the opinion of the majority, which was the right opinion, incidentally. But Calvert being Calvert, of course, being an aggressive person, his idea would have been to get back across the Irrawaddy to blow up as many British as he could find on the way back, you were saying, which would have caused a lot of trouble. And I don't think he realized at that stage the state of mind of the troops. Not in our column, of course, it was the same thing that happened everywhere else. I'm only talking about my particular column at the moment. However, he decided that if we were going to break up, we'd do it properly. And we'd have an airdrop supply, which we did. He decided on the groups, who was to command them and so on and lead them. And he also decided on having a good supply of rations and things, and there were extra maps and machine guns, atomic, all sorts of things dropped. So we broke up into our little groups, and there was some rum dropped, so all the officers, British officers, the Gurkha officers, and the Burma Rifle officers, we all gathered together and drank a toast to the king and to three column, and said, well, right, here we go, and let's hope we all meet again in India. And then we all set off in our little groups. I had a platoon. With me was Taffy Griffiths, who was the Burma Rifle, Captain Taffy Griffiths, who'd been in the ambush at the railway, as I told you earlier. A very brave, cool person, much older than myself. He was commanding my group, and I had a platoon with me. And I suppose half of us, half the group decided that we would cross, go and head for the Irrawaddy much further south than where we'd come in. And while the others decided they'd go back the way we'd come. And and so we set off, not knowing, you know, what would happen. And we were now going across the dry zone, and there was no water. And although our packs were heavy enough, with the ration we just got, there was no water, and it was terrible. We were very thirsty. We had to take action to avoid a terrific forest fire which suddenly appeared on us. And eventually, the second night, morning, we were early, we set off, and we were feeling terribly thirsty. Everything was black and dry around us. And suddenly, a little line of green seemed to appear in front. It looked, it must be mirage. But as we got closer, it got more and more, and then suddenly we came into an oasis, a paradise. It was a Dawa Chong, which was a beautiful, cool, clear stream, which we hadn't seen for ages. And so we were able to have a good drink and fill up with water, which was a great saving to us. And then we moved off, and Taffy sent his Karens, a couple of Karens ahead, just to Reki and the Irrawaddy River. Because, as I had mentioned earlier, we were in the trap, you remember, and the Japanese had commandeered all the boats on the east bank and had convoy systems to stop us getting across the river. But as we approached the Irrawaddy, this is in broad daylight, mind you, the Karens came back to say they'd got a boat, one of them had, the other one a statement. And so we reached the river, and there was this big sampan, which was the home of a Burmese family. For some reason, which I'm quite sure what, there may have been some little trouble there, they'd come from the river and to the bank to stop to adjust something or other. And that's how we got them. Now, I don't know what it was sheer luck or whether it was a sign from God or what, I just don't know. But it just came. There it was, at our feet, and it could take about 20 people. So we decided, right, so in broad daylight, we sent a small party across the other side for a bridgehead, and there was no trouble the other side. And then put the men on it, and they went across, and we were going last, Taffy and I and our orderlies in the little canoe. And who should turn up? Bobby Thompson with his group. So he asked, I'll use the boat as well. So we said, okay, after us. So we left them and we went across in this little thing. And I remember it was the one and only time I ever saw Taffy terrified. And then the reason was that he couldn't swim. And during the retreat from Burma, he'd been crossing a river in a truck when the ferry sank, and he was taken right down and into this thing, and he was only rescued by the Burmese fellow who dived in and pulled him out, and got him out in time. So, however, when we got the other side, he was his old self again. But the funny thing about that boat was that after Bobby Thompson, Calvert's group came to the same spot, and they used the same boat. So the three of us got across. It was just sheer luck. Quite amazing to think that we got across so easily and in broad daylight. Absolutely remarkable. Because a lot of the others never had the same sort of fortune as we did. It was just sheer luck. And also, I think, because we had come quite a bit further south. And also, I think, because we were very quick off the mark and got across the danger zone before the Japs really got into position as well. Well, from then on, it was a case of we had to get back to the Chinwin, the river, which meant the next danger spot would be the railway line. We got across that all right. And then the next danger thing was what we call the escarpment, which was a big high ridge of mountains between us and the Chinwin. And by this time we were getting very short of food, obviously, and we decided, well, because before we set off, we'd all decided, and in fact this was Wingate's orders, were to get back as many people as possible, that we would not deliberately attack any Japanese, we would not look for trouble, and we would avoid it as much as possible, for obvious reasons. I mean, that was the thing. So we hadn't gone out of our way to look for trouble, and we weren't. But we decided we'd have to get into a village to get some rice and stuff before we got onto the escarpment, because there was nothing there. And just as Taffy and I were discussing this, along comes Bobby Thompson with his group. And so we decided we'd join up, because we'd be double strength, and then we could go into a village safely, which we did. So we went into a village, and we got all this rice and stuff. And then we went off into the foothills, and we camped, and decided that the best thing was to have a good meal and just cook everything up and eat it, which we did. And then, just as we were moving off, there was machine gun fire. The position was, we had this big chong, either side with big hills like that, and the chong wound its way through. And to one side of us was a little hill, and behind that was playing ground going towards the way we'd come. And a patrol of some sort had come that way. And I put two sections there at that time. And this was the moment when the fact of seeing those Gurkhas wounded suddenly had effect. And it wasn't only in my column, it happened everywhere. It wasn't, but this was what I personally saw. Suddenly I saw these two Gurkha sections coming towards me. They weren't running, they were just walking at a fast rate, came straight towards me, and there was a sort of blank look on their faces. So I said, come on, get back into position. But they just completely ignored me and went past. There was no sign of sort of panic. There was just complete blackness, as though they were saying to themselves, well, nothing to do with us. And the Saab said we had to avoid trouble. Why the hell should we get wounded now? You know, nothing to do with us. They walked past us. In fact, the whole river Chang was full of all the Gurkhas. And there was, you know, Taffy and Bobby were in the river trying to get, and my Jemadar trying to get some of the people up into position on the other side. And an old Doc Rao, our doctor, Indian doctor, thin as a stick, marvellous man, he'd been sorting out his equipment. He wasn't going to budge or anything. So I had to wait with him. My orderly would stay with me. And he got his stuff together before he moved off. And then from just above us, the voice called down. It was Sher Bahadur Ali. He was still there with his machine at the top. So I went up to him, and he said, I think they're down there, you see. Shall I give them a burst? So I said, no, leave them. And we came down, and we joined the rest. Meanwhile, the firing had stopped. I think that they were just... obviously, someone was sitting in a undercover, firing his pen gun up in the air, some machine gun up in the air. It was probably not a Japanese patrol. I think they would come after us. It was probably a Burma, you know, National Army patrol who were working for the Japanese. However, we managed to get the troops together, and we went up into the mountain. We lost half a platoon. The Jemadar of that platoon, who had been in Bobby Thompson's group, and half his men had gone up the other way. We never saw them again, except that they did get back safely. It was a very ticklish situation for someone like myself at 19 to suddenly find, you know, that here were these marvellous troops and people who had never, you know, so brave and everything else. And I suppose I realised, though, that everybody, right from Wingate down, had reached a state, except perhaps Calvert, of course, Calvert being Calvert, had reached a state where they would do things that they wouldn't normally do because of the hunger and the continuous marching and the continuous tension of trying to wonder where the Japs are coming from and everything else, had built up this sort of fear, whatever it was, in one. And the idea was, right, you know, get back. And it's easy to criticize, you know, from this state, but no one knows how they would have reacted in the same situation. It was this that sort of operation. It was something quite different from a normal action to have in a normal battle. It was something absolutely quite extraordinary, and you have to take it in that context as to why that happened. And it was something that happened to a lot of other people as well. However, I had a chat with the Jemadar and his book, The People, and the impression I got was that I wouldn't have any more trouble. If we had any more trouble, they'd be all right. They'd got it out of their system. They felt a bit ashamed, but they got it out of their system, and in future I felt quite confident we wouldn't have any more trouble. I don't think we would have, although actually we never saw any more Japs after that, because we got back all right. It was a terrible march to the escarpment, but Bobby Thompson is one of the world's best map readers going, I think. We got through all right. And we eventually reached the Chinwin at Satang, where we were met by the Patiala Sikhs with their marvelous colonel, whose name sadly I can't remember. And they looked after us very well in their little mess that night and gave the men a lot of food. And the officers went in the officers' mess. And they laid on this huge curry for us. And I suppose, I mean, we should have been told not to eat, because we hadn't fuel. But even but our doctor was there, and he wasn't going to stop eating. So anyway, we settled down to eat the curry, and they looked at us with amazement, these Sikhs. Eventually, I think there was Bobby, of course, and Tappy and Doc. They gave up eventually. But I went on a bit longer, being younger, and finished up practically everything. And the strange twist to that was that some months later, my friend Ian McHorton was travelling in a train, and the compartment he was sharing, there was a young Sikh from the Patialas. And he said, oh, he said, you must know my friend Harold James. He said, I know that man. He said, my God, how he can eat curry. So, anyway, that's the reputation we got. Anyway, the damage was done. And then from then on, of course, we were looked after. We made up jeeps and trucks, and all our lice-ridden stuff was burnt, and we were given some new stuff to put on. And we had more damage was done because we ate some more different people's messes. And by the time we reached Imphal, we were all put into the hospital there, just rest. And by that time, every time we ate, tummy used to come up like that, like a balloon.